By using as my maxim, everyone with the following fingerprints may steal, I can universalize that, and it turns out only one person is stealing. And as you know, a social system can survive with only one person stealing, everybody else respecting private property. Because if everybody steals, then there's no sense of private property, and it doesn't make sense talking about stealing at all. But if only one person does, and so the point is, I can go ahead and steal as long as I cleverly word the maxim that I'm going to test by Kant's system. Now, I'm going to tell you immediately, anybody who studies philosophy and is very astute, it has a comeback to that. But then I've got a comeback to the comeback, so let's go over that real quickly. I say, Kant, I can make a categorical imperative out of me stealing. Here's how I do it. Everyone with the following fingerprints may steal. Universalize that. Okay? No problem. Now, the defender of Kant would say, when you put into your maxim this reference to everyone with the following fingerprints, you were incorporating something that has nothing to do with morality. You were bringing something that's irrelevant to morality into the reasoning. And that's not fair. If you're going to talk about the moral law, you can only test maxims that deal with moral factors, not amoral factors like fingerprints. And that sounds pretty good. That is to say, you test maxims only when they mention things relevant to morality. And here's my comeback to the comeback. Well, that must mean that you know what the moral law is before you test the moral law. Because from the outset, if we're going to be neutral and autonomous, for all I know, fingerprints are morally relevant. Now, I don't happen to believe that. I don't expect you to believe it. We're Christians. We know better. But we have a reason for saying we know better. My point is, Kant cannot carry out his autonomous discovery of the moral law unless he already knows what is morally relevant or irrelevant to begin with. But if you already know what is morally relevant or irrelevant, why are you proposing a test to discover it? Y'all with me? Okay. Three more elements of Kant's ethic. Kant maintains, he argues, that ought implies can. Ought implies can. No one is under an obligation to do what he is unable to do. If you ought to do X, then that presupposes that you are able to do X. No one is obligated, no one has a duty to do what he's unable to do. And this is a very appealing element of Kant's ethic. And I would tell you, before I criticize it, that there are senses in which Christian moralists would want to say the same thing. It would be entirely wrong for us to hold somebody morally accountable to jump over a certain fence if they're in a wheelchair. It isn't fair to lay a duty on somebody that they cannot follow. Nevertheless, Kant has overgeneralized here because you have to think about other considerations. Sometimes people have an obligation what they're unable to do, and their inability is self-imposed. You have an obligation to drive home sober. But if you've been drinking all night, you have imposed on yourself an inability to live up to your duty. Okay? So from a Christian standpoint, we would say it's pretty clear that ought implies can, but or ought implies ability. It does not necessarily imply present ability. And that a person's moral culpability continues when their present inability has come about through their irresponsibility. And let me take this a step further. According to Christian theology, we all come into this world unable to keep the moral law. All right, Paul tells us in Romans 8 that the natural man is not able to keep the law of God. Well, Kant would argue if they're not able to, then it makes no sense to say they're responsible to. But we would argue in this particular case, not all cases, but in a case like this, inability does not take away responsibility. Why? Because the inability has been inherited from one who represented us. Now, what do you think Kantians are going to say at this point? It's what we're saying is, in Adam, we all became drunk, and that's why we can't drive now. And it's our fault. We are responsible for Adam's irresponsible choice. Well, the argument would be, it's not fair for people to suffer the consequence of another person's irresponsibility. Well, I mean, on the surface, that's an unfortunate, silly thing to say. It may not be fair, but it happens all the time. When a drunk driver's out on the road and somebody else dies because he runs into them, that is not something you can say, well, it can't happen. People can't suffer from the irresponsibility of others. They do. But then Kant would say, but it's not right. It's not fair. It turns out, though, that even in our fallen world, we understand assumed moral culpability. Parents are held accountable for what their children do. And whole universities are held accountable for what their football teams do. We understand that. We don't field a new football team of different individual players that were not involved in this cheating scandal or whatever it was. The whole university is disqualified from league play or whatever it may be. And so we understand representation and the assumption of responsibility from others. So I can't get any further into that, but ought implies can is a slippery thing. You've got to make sure you qualify it properly and not get to the place where, for instance, in Arminian theology, you say God can't hold people accountable, you know, for not believing if he didn't predestine them. It's not their fault. So they must have free will. They must be able to believe the gospel if God's going to hold them accountable for not believing. Well, that is rooted in a Kantian outlook that is not sufficiently qualified. I don't think it's accurate. Another thing Kant holds to in his ethic that I want you to remember is that man's will must be autonomous, not heteronomous. 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 Coming from two words, heter, meaning other. You know what heterosexual is, right? Sex with someone other than your own gender. Heterosexual over against homosexual. Heteronomous uses the word nomos, which means law. So heteronomous means the law of another. The law of another. According to Kant, it is never moral to be heteronomous. It is not moral to do things because it's the law of another. True morality must be autonomous. It must be self-imposed. Man must act from an inner principle, not an external authority. Man must act from an inner principle, not an external authority. And so the truly good man, the one who follows the moral law, is autonomous, and with the use of his rational capability, discovers the categorical imperative and imposes it on himself, doing his duty for duty's sake. And so that at least gives you the broad picture of Kant's ethic. The last thing that I'll tell you about his ethic, he's fairly well known for this, and I'll quote it to you, the maxim, treat every man as an end in himself and never as a means only. Treat every man as an end in himself and never as a means only. What he's getting at here is you shouldn't use other people instrumentally. Okay? If I'm treating you nicely because I expect you to give me a ride home, or I'm treating you nicely because you're the boss and I want a promotion, then I'm not acting in a moral way. What we are to do is to treat people as an end, treat a person as an end in himself. That is, I must treat you not as a stepping stone for accomplishing my desires, but I must treat you in terms of your own desire and what you need. Now, would you say that that in some ways is a formally reflects a Christian ethic? I would. I would say Christians shouldn't just use, quote-unquote, use other people. Kant acknowledges that sometimes when we do what is right toward other people, it does benefit us. What he says is you should never use them as a means only. It may be an incidental accompaniment that it's a means to your good when you are good to other people. His point is you should treat them, you should treat that individual as an end in himself, not a means. And from a Christian standpoint, we would change this and we say we should treat other individuals as an end in themselves. Well, because they are children of God, we should treat them for the sake of the glory of God and the image of God in the right way, and not for our own self-interest. I would argue, if we had the time, and we don't, but I think you can develop this, that when Kant makes the man, the individual, an end in himself, he's going to eventually not be able to have a workable ethic in society, because if everybody's an autonomous end in itself, well, then who do I act? Whose end should I take into account when there's a conflict between individuals, myself and you, or you and others, or the entire society over against a renegade minority? Again, I'll let you work those things out. Let's talk about Kant's religiosity for a moment. Can we believe in God? We cannot cognitively believe in God. Cognitively means applying the concepts of the mind to God. And the reason why we cannot believe in God cognitively is because that would mean we're applying concepts to something that is not perceptual. You know, we're trying to use understanding for something that doesn't have a basis in sensation. How about the cosmological argument? Kant says the cosmological argument illegitimately applies the concept of cause beyond experience, beyond phenomenal experience. God is a noumenal object, not a phenomenal object. The mind has not created God through the application of time, space, causation, and so forth concepts. And so when we try to talk about a God that's beyond our noumenal experience, that is, when we try to talk about a noumenal God, we cannot use our phenomenal categories. And this is a very strong argument. I won't use the Kantian way of putting it, but I can express it to you this way. If somebody says, well, now look at the world around you. In this world, we see that this event has a cause that brought it about. And we see that this object has a cause that brought it about. In fact, everywhere in the natural world, I see causal relationships at work. And so my question is, what's the cause of the natural world? And immediately you should, if you're philosophically astute, say, well, whatever cause you're talking about now cannot be something beyond the natural world, because the way in which you've proven the causal principle is only by looking at the natural world. So by asking what's the cause of the natural world as a whole, the only answer that's legitimate is some kind of natural cause. You can't jump from the realm where you've learned all these things, nature, to something that's beyond nature. The causal principle has no meaning outside of the world where you've learned about causal relationships. And so Kant very properly points out that if you're using a phenomenal concept, you can't apply it to the noumena, to what is beyond phenomena, what's beyond experience. You can only say, well, whatever caused everything must be part of the phenomenal experience of man. The teleological argument argues from order to a designer. Kant says the teleological argument only shows an intelligence very great, not supreme. Again, if you see order in the natural world, then there may be an intelligence that's great that brings that order about, but you haven't shown a supreme intelligence. You haven't shown a transcendent intelligence. And for this, just go back and look at your notes on David Hume. Hume has already shown that the argument, at best, demonstrates that this world is similar to human intelligence, but it doesn't tell us that it goes much beyond that. Finally, the ontological argument, which Kant thought was the basis of all the other arguments for God's existence. And according to Kant, in the ontological argument, we improperly treat the term exist as a predicate similar to others. Okay? When it's assumed that the existence of God is entailed in the greatness or perfection of God, Kant says you're treating existence like a predicate, like is red, is round, is big, is tall, runs fast. You're treating it in the same way as you treat other predicates. But if you think about the concept of $100, if you're going to follow this, most students get kind of off track, but he says, as a concept, the concept of $100 is not increased or diminished by being a concept of real dollars or a concept of possible dollars. As a concept, its intention, to use the logical expression, is not increased or decreased by whether you consider a possible $100 or a real $100. Some people will, you know, blithely say, well, there's obviously a difference between a real $100 and a possible $100. I mean, you can't buy a nice steak with possible $100, but you can with a real $100. Kant was not so stupid as to miss that. He knew there was a difference between possibility and reality. But he said, as a concept, there is no difference between a possible and a real $100. As a concept, you don't add anything to the extension, or pardon me, the intention of the term from a conceptual standpoint. To increase the intention of a term is something like this. Think about all dogs. Now, I can increase the intention, that is, I can lower or I can augment the meaning of that when I say all brown dogs. Brown here is a predicate. And what I've done is I've taken a concept that's this big. Think of it in set terms. I have a set this big, all dogs. But now when I add the predicate brown, what happens to the set? It's now smaller. Now it's all brown dogs. And then if I say all brown dogs in California, it's a smaller set. So the concept of dog, brown dog in California, brown dog in California run over by a truck, whatever it may be, I'm sorry. What we are doing here is we are changing the intention of the concept by adding predicates. I add the predicate brown, I add the predicate in California, I add the predicate run over by a truck. Okay? But you don't change the intention of the concept of $100 by saying it exists. The concept is still the same. And so Kant is saying here, the ontological argument illegitimately treats existence as a predicate when in fact it doesn't operate like other predicates at all, because this predicate does not increase or decrease the intention of the concept. So he doesn't buy any of the arguments for God's existence. However, Kant does say that the idea of God, the idea of freedom, and the idea of immortality, these three, God, freedom, and immortality, are postulates of practical reason. Postulates of practical reason. Make sure you write that down, then I'll explain it. The ideas of God, freedom, and immortality are postulates of practical reason. Is he saying that you can cognitively know God, know about immortality, or know your own personal freedom? No. That would mean that it's something that the concepts of pure reason apply to. But we already know that the concepts of pure reason only apply to phenomena, right? Those things that begin perceptually. But you don't have a perception of freedom. You certainly don't have a perception of your immortality or a perception of God. So these three are not cognitively known. Nevertheless, they are, notice what he said, postulates of practical reason. That is to say, in order to behave properly in this world, we must live as if these ideas are true. Man must behave, underlined a couple of times, as if. Man must behave as if the ideas of God, freedom, and immortality are true, so as to act ethically, and in particular, so as not to be hindered by the disparity in this world between virtue and happiness. You look around you, you look for those people who are showing that they have goodwill, they're universalizing their maxims, they're not treating people as just a means to an end, but treating people because they're valuable in themselves. You look around, are those people who are living morally, doing duty for duty's sake, are they the happy people in this world? Kant says, oh, there's a great disparity. And when I see that doing my duty doesn't bring about, or being virtuous doesn't bring about happiness, there's a great disparity, then the inclination is to what? To not want to do my duty. And so if you think as if you will be immortal and there's a God, now of course you can't know anything cognitively about immortality or God, but if you think as if you are immortal and there's a God, then you'll still follow your duty even though virtue and happiness are not brought together in this life. That is, it's almost as though you'll be good if you believe in Santa Claus. You know, everybody knows there's no Santa Claus. But as long as children believe in Santa Claus, that will be a practical postulate for them. A postulate that regulates their practices, the way they act in this world. And so if you believe in God and immortality, that will have a practical, ethical outcome. The disparity between virtue and happiness will not be an obstacle to you following the moral law. Well, I've already criticized that. I mean, what kind of ethic is this? What kind of religiosity is this? It is mystical and moralistic religiosity. Now, do you remember why, or in remembering, do you see why I told you about the influence of Kant's mother and her German pietism? Pietism emphasizes not a creedal Christianity, but a Christianity of feeling that leads us to live a proper kind of pious life. Kant felt that everyone should live a pious life. And so what he has here is a mystical concept of God. If you will, a not anti-rational, but certainly awe-rational concept of God. You can't know God cognitively, but in the practical affairs of life, you must live as if there's a God. Okay, let me see if I can bring this lecture on Kant to a close. I have three major points I want to make now about Kant, all by way of criticism. Three major points. First, add to the criticisms that we've been giving so far, Kant has introduced a deadly dichotomy in philosophical reasoning. A deadly dichotomy. Kant says two things fill us with admiration and awe. Two things fill us with admiration and awe: the starry heavens above and the moral law within. Two things fill us with admiration and awe: the starry heavens above and the moral law within. And what you need to understand is that according to Kant, those two things that fascinate us cannot be understood by the same principles of explanation. The starry heavens above pertain to the external world. And they're fascinating, but remember, they can only be understood, or anything in the world. The starry heavens is just a literary illustration. The external world can only be understood by the principle of causation. The external world can only be understood by the principle of causation. Well, what's the other thing that fascinates us? The moral law within. There's an internal world that can only be understood by the principle of autonomous freedom. Autonomous freedom. Two things fill us with admiration and awe: the starry heavens above, understood by the causal principle that says everything's predictable, and then the moral law within, understood by the principle of autonomous freedom, which means nothing is predictable. Chris, you were saying? I thought maybe you'd like to make the application for us. What you see, then, is that Kant says reality cannot be understood by a single unified set of principles of explanation. You cannot have common principles of explanation to explain the starry heavens and the moral law within, because one area is understood, or one sphere is understood, by a principle of predictability, deterministic causality. The other is understood in terms of autonomous freedom that is not predictable and causal. And so in Kant, we have a major dichotomy between two ways of explaining reality. We've given up a unified field of knowledge, a unified philosophy that it can explain reality. Moreover, this dichotomy is even worse. The dichotomy also leads to a separation between phenomena and noumena. There's a dichotomy between things as they appear to us, the way we must think, the way in which the mind creates objects that are intelligible. There's a dichotomy between those phenomena and the way things are in and of themselves, the Dingen Sich, the noumena. Not only do we have a dichotomy then in terms of understanding all of reality, it turns out even that part of our experience that we understand is different from the reality that lies behind that experience. So you have a dichotomy between appearance and reality. Which again destroys the traditional philosophical enterprise. We never gain objective, certain knowledge. The certainty that we have is only psychological in character, noumenal in character. It is never objective, based in reality, things themselves. Okay, so that's my first line of argument, not argument, but critique of Kant. He's introduced two deadly dichotomies: causation versus freedom, as different ways of explaining reality, and then a dichotomy, even within that dichotomy, between appearance and reality. The world that we know, the starry heavens above, is only the world of appearance, not the way things are in and of themselves. Okay, a second line of argument or criticism. According to Kant, the connectedness, I know that's an unusual word, but you'll understand, the connectedness of experience is due to what he calls, and I'll give you the technical term, the transcendental unity of apperception. The transcendental unity of apperception. If you look up here on the board, our divided up egg again, remember one of these dialectics for organizing a worldview is the self. And I'm going to carve out just a little section here as a reminder to you that the self involves a transcendental unity of apperception. What we're getting at here is if you have all these chaotic sensations coming in and you say the mind is organizing and constructing them into intelligible objects, then who's running the machinery, if you will? Who's running the program here? Well, it turns out there needs a transcendental, that is a presupposition of intelligible experience, a transcendental unity of apperception is called for. There must be an enduring self that is every experience that someone has, every datum of experience presupposes an I, a subject that is thinking or having that perception. There is an I think, if you will, in every datum of experience that connects the parts and extends into the future. How do I know? Why do I work on this assumption that the experience I'm having now is the experience I'm now having? First, I didn't have the glass. Now I have the glass. Well, there is a transcendental unity of apperception that is the self, if you will, having the experience and what? Uniting the self over time as well into the future. So what brings all of this together? What is the experiencing unity of the apperception, and what is it that gives identity over time? Kant said is something we can't know anything about. It's mystical, but there's a transcendental unity of apperception. And so the bottom line is the subject of my thought is merely a big X, an unknown place marker. The subject of my thoughts is merely an X, a place marker. There must be some unity of apperception, but remember, you can't know the self because it's beyond perception. You don't perceive yourself having perceptions, do you? Or think back of David Hume. What was the self for Hume? A bundle of perceptions. A bundle. Now, Kant has the good sense to say, well, there must be an enduring self, a transcendental unity to all these apperceptions. But what can he tell us about that transcendental unity? What can he tell us about this bundling of the perceptions? And the answer is nothing. The self knows itself only through its thoughts. Or if you will, the only thing you know about the self are the predicates of the self, that is, the perceptions that you have. There's a place marker, an X, that is having those perceptions, but you can't say anything about the X. All you can talk about is the perceptions of the X. Have I lost any of you in this? Something has got to bundle all these perceptions together. We have no idea what the bundling is. So you only know yourself in terms of your own thoughts, the predicates of yourself, the perceptions of yourself. Has Kant dealt with Hume's problem of the self? No, what's he done? Once again, he has reified the problem. He's just turned it into something in itself. Hume said there's a bundling of perceptions. Oh, how's that possible? Kant says, well, there's a place marker. You can't know anything about that place marker. All you can know is the perceptions that qualify the place marker. So that's my second major line of criticism, is that Kant has left us now still with the transcendental problem of the unity of apperception. What is the self? What is this man, this mind, that is having these perceptions? And then my last criticism, which I want you to master, because I'll ask you about this on the test. Remember my introductory remarks? Here's my introductory summary of Kant. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go back and I'm going to blast every element of it real briefly. Kant synthesized empiricism and rationalism, one. Saved science, two. Made room for faith, three. Okay, so here's the great accomplishment of Kant. This is what Kant hoped for. This is what his disciples would tell you. He, one, synthesized empiricism and rationalism. Two, he saved science. Three, he made room for faith. And here's Dr. Bonson's reply. The little boy sitting on the curb of the parade saying, you know what, I think the king doesn't have any clothes on. He synthesized empiricism and rationalism. Yes, but the empiricism that he dealt with was the empiricism of chaotic sensations. And the rationalism that he brought to this empiricism was the arbitrary assumption of a universal internal structure of the mind. An arbitrary assumption of a universal internal structure of the mind. So, yes, he synthesized empiricism and rationalism by destroying them both. What you have is chaos out here and arbitrary structure over here. This is just, if you will, raspberries. You know, I'm sitting here thinking, Kant felt, his disciples felt he did this great thing, and I'm going, big deal. Chaos and arbitrary structure. That's how you synthesize them. Two, he saved science. Did he save science? I'd say he psychologized science. The order that we find in the world scientifically is in fact not in the outside world, not in objects. That order is imposed by the mind. And that's what I mean, that Kant saved science by psychologizing science. Of course we've got to think scientifically. Our mind makes us do so. But then we don't really know reality in itself. We just know the world as our mind makes us think about the world. We only know the world phenomenally. So, a second raspberry. Big deal. He saved science by doing what Hume did. Hume said, well, scientific inference is really based in imagination. Kant said, oh, I can answer that. It's a structure of the mind. It's still internal, not external. And thirdly, he made room for faith. Yes, well, what kind of faith did he make room for? Non-cognitive mysticism, an as-if God that you can feel, but you can know nothing about conceptually. A non-cognitive mysticism that reduces to moralism. The reason why you pursue this non-cognitive belief in God is so that you'll live a better life. So yeah, there's room for faith as long as it's irrational, moralistic faith and not a faith that gives us metaphysical conclusions. Do you all see the significance here? The third raspberry is, yeah, but look at the faith that he saves. That's not Christian faith. And so he synthesizes empiricism and rationalism by destroying them both. He saves science by destroying it and leaves room for faith by destroying it in terms of the biblical understanding of faith. I don't want to take away from the monumental stature of Kant. Anybody who studied philosophy in America would tell you Kant's far more important, far more intelligent than Dr. Bonson, who has no reputation at all. I realize I'm just the little boy sitting on the parade route. But I also realize, and I think you do too, that the king has no clothes. When we come back together for our next philosophy course, we'll look at the implications of the king's nakedness in the 19th and 20th centuries.